Welcome to the Fourth Watch Podcast, a curated conversation with some of the most interesting voices in the media. I'm Steve Krakauer. Today we're talking legacy media versus independent media, Facebook and Twitter, the business of newsletters, all that with Charlie Worzel, now of The Atlantic and Galaxy Brain writer. This is episode 27. From whether Facebook is good or evil, and why it's a lot more complicated than that, to the topic of nuance in the media generally, to his semi-feud, if you will, with Glenn Greenwald and living in Montana, far outside the Acela media, we start with Worzel leaving Substack and taking his newsletter over to The Atlantic. I want to start, obviously, with the news that was announced this week, your move to The Atlantic. And it's interesting because, you know, you had left the New York Times in April of this year, hung out in the world of Substack for about 7 months or so. And you wrote in this great piece about all the reasons why you're leaving, a very nuanced piece, which I think, you know, I want to have a nuanced conversation and also a nuanced conversation about nuance. So we'll get to that like nerdy newsletter, business of newsletter stuff later also. But I want to know, because I think immediately when you left the New York Times, went to Substack, when now you're leaving Substack and go to The Atlantic, people want to make a story about that, that this says something about the traditional versus, traditional and legacy versus new and independent. And I want to, do you think there's a broader thing here? And I guess if so, what do you think that is? And if not, why do you think everything has to be a broader story, especially in this current environment about newsletters?
Yeah, it's been really disorienting. And like, I mean, I understand it, right? And I actually, in this post, I tried to like hedge against it, right? Like I'm figuring this was going to become a future of news conversation. And I wanted, you know, I mean, to some degree, it is, you know, in the sense that like, I want to do work in the media space, in the journalism space that's on, you know, that's sort of new and interesting. And I think newsletters as a format are great for all the, you know, reasons everyone talks about. Voicy, you know, I think it's kind of like a cheat code, honestly, to do the most interesting writing, like publications from, you know, the Times to everywhere, right? Or, you know, if you write something as a column or an op-ed or whatever, like there's sort of a way in which to speak and do it. But then like, if you do a newsletter, it's like, spoiler, it's the same thing. And they just like let you write in a really interesting kind of internet native way, which you know, everyone's saying newsletters are blogs. I mostly agree. So there's that element, right? Like, and following that. So I get that. But yeah, to some degree, like I've always also just been trying with all these moves to do the work that I think is most interesting and most relevant and most helpful. For me as like a writer, as a thinker, as a reporter, and so like I'm making these moves less because of like I think this is where the wind is blowing with the whole industry or anything, and more like, oh, I think this is where I can do the best work. And you know, Substack, I see it as like an awesome experiment, you know, and also a thing that I really needed to do. I really was having some trouble with my columns in the Times. Like I felt I was being overly declarative. I felt like I needed more, as you said earlier, like to inject a little more nuance, a little uncertainty. I wasn't sure about how I felt about a lot of things, and I wanted to.
So it wasn't an editor thing. It was more of your own sort of self-criticism of what you were putting out there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I got to be honest, like to work the New York Times is a dream for a journalist in terms of the amount of resources, in terms of the reach and the platform. I had good working relationships with people there. You know, I had for a person who's 34 years old, I had a heck of a lot of freedom to write about things that were interesting. And but you know, at the end of the day, too, like I just found that the work that I wanted to do was gravitating towards this other format. And I'd also be lying if I didn't say like, it was the idea of, you know, trying to start my own thing and sort of testing out my real market value and being my own boss. Like all those things were really exciting. And I felt like if I was going to make a move to do it that moment in time, which was April of 2021, that was the time to do it. if I waited 6 months, you know, it might not have been possible. So, you know, that was the reason.
Yeah. And you did, and you have some good lessons in there, I think, about your time at Substack, which I want to get into later. But I agree, you know, this podcast came out of the Fourth Watch newsletter, which I started in December of 2019. And I agree, you know, I've written columns before, I've been a reporter. I think there's a different feel to newsletters, and it does feel sort of the moment. In podcasts, in a way as well, there's an intimacy to it. You know, you send an email, it says it's from the author of the newsletter when you receive it, and you open it, and it feels like it's almost to you. And it's different in that way. You're getting this direct relationship with the reader, as opposed to having to rely on people finding you or spreading it on Twitter, which I want to talk about later also. So I agree. I think that there's something to it. And I also, though, at the same time, am kind of laugh at the way newsletters are being portrayed. I when Puck News launched, and they described them, they said journalists are the original influencers, and I was like, I don't know if that's really true. You know, they want their and they do some good newsletters over at Puck News, but it's like, is that really what we're doing? Is it really about this, like, I'm an influencer now, and that's why I have a newsletter, or is it about the format and sort of the editorial voice you can bring to it?
Yeah, this is such a complicated conversation, right? Because, like, I mean, if you go and start your own, you know, Substack, and you become a content, like an independent content creator, right? And that path is what, you know, social media influencers are, right? And part of that being an influencer is like a degree of incredible freedom and a degree of incredible precarity, right? There's so much upside. There's also a lot of downside. It's a hustle. It's one of those sort of like 90-10, right? 10% or maybe even less, maybe or fewer, maybe, you know, 2 or 3% succeed greatly, and then the rest are grinding.
The sports analogy is that there's a much larger ceiling and much larger floor, I think, you know, if you go that route, right?
Yeah. And so, I mean, to some extent, like, the idea that it's a tricky thing, right, to say like journalists are the original influencers, because like it's sort of, I think, what a lot of legacy newsrooms would want to shy away from, right? Which is to say, like, we don't want it to be so personality driven, right? that you know, it's all about the storyteller and not about the story. At the same time, it's always been the case, yes, that like in most organizations, in most newsrooms, at least for the last, you know, whatever, 30, 40 years, there's always been the you know, sort of like the star people who, you know, who bring a lot of either prestige or excitement or whatever to the thing. And in some cases, it's always about the storyteller and their story and their ability to do it. So yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that they're just being kind of like overly cute over there with that marketing. But it does sort of speak right now to this idea that, like, you know, individual journalists who are really good at what they do and have, you know, really original voices and stuff during this sort of glut of content that the internet allows us to put out, you know, they have a lot of power, and Substack is one way of journalists kind of exercising that power. But you know, it's there's always going to be parts of it that are fraught and precarious, especially when, you know, some people go out on their own because they think they have a certain amount of power, and it turns out that they don't, and you know, that can hurt in really big ways.
Yeah, and you know, it's. I think social media is sort of the elephant in the room, and what I want to get to after this also, because I think that there's, you talk about the influencers, you know, the influencer vehicles, you know, the amplification vehicles for across the board, legacy media and new media is Twitter, is Facebook and Instagram and the new platforms of ways of reaching a new audience and feeling like you've got fans and likes and all that. So I want to talk about that next, but before we get there, I want to just go back to The Atlantic. Cause I often will critique legacy media. I have to say, I think The Atlantic is really good. I think some of the best COVID pieces that I've read over the last 18 months have originated in The Atlantic. I think that there's a certain nuance. I think heterodox is kind of a term that gets thrown around, but whether it's heterodox thinking or kind of a unique spin on something, I always find myself reading something different there. And so I wonder what resonated with you where you're like, okay, if I'm going to leave my Substack, this is the way to go.
So like you mentioned there's a couple things. You mentioned the COVID coverage, and for me, you know, I basically from late February 2020 noticed, I mean, I'm one of those people that signed up and paid because for a subscription there, because I ended up hitting the paywall so much that I felt that it was necessary. And it was honestly one of the few places where that happened. And it was due to that. And what I noticed immediately of it was that, like, the COVID coverage especially was framing articles around really interesting questions that I was encountering in my own life. So it was like, not only was it a really interesting reported explanation of a thing, but also at the same time, it had a servicey element to it, right? Like, it was like, I don't understand what's going on with X, right? Or I don't know what's going on, why everyone's buying, you know, toilet paper or whatever. And it was like, I felt like they were picking off and answering these questions, right? And providing this service with also like new ideas, interesting analysis. So I was really drawn by that because that's how I work as a journalist, right? Like, I am someone who I basically am not good at sticking with a beat or a story or a thing unless I'm like encountering it in my own life and trying to answer questions for myself. There's like a real self-serving element to that. It's like, I want to, you know, kind of process the world and do that in public a little bit. Because of the fact that that's how they adapted to this really big news event, I thought, well, like, this is a group of people kind of work and think like me. And then, you know, as I started talking about this whole endeavor and also about coming in and writing other things for the magazine, it's very clear in a way that, It sort of seemed like, unlike any other place I'd ever worked, that it was really based around, this is going to sound really like flat and simple, but it's based around interesting ideas, right? It's like less based off of, we need to get this news out here. You know, like, I was at the opinion section of the Times. I have a lot of respect for everyone there and everything, but, you know, at the end of the day, even the opinion section, New York Times is a daily newspaper, right? It's the news always leads, the news always wins. I'm not, you know, I'm not like a scoop beast, you know, I'm not never been the thing that I gravitate towards the most. And I just kind of got a sense talking to different people at the publication, including writers, that like, it's a place that really privileges writers, and is really interested in the most interesting idea, even if it's a little off kilter or off topic or off the news. And I just thought, like, well, I've never worked at a place like that. I think that there's going to be a lot of, a lot of similarities similar ways of thinking.
Is Facebook good or evil? A debate of sorts, but also a discussion about why that's not really the right question to be asking. I want to talk about Facebook. You've written a lot about Facebook over at Galaxy Brain. I imagine that will be a continued topic as well. And it's something that, look, I think I get that Facebook is a gigantic, very powerful company. I think that you watch Mark Zuckerberg kind of wading his way through the metaverse, and it's sort of awkward and weird in that video that he did. But to me, it feels like there's an altruism to Zuckerberg himself and to the company, where if you're putting it in the most non-nuanced terms, it's in good versus evil, you know, like good intentions versus nefarious intentions. I think, unlike most giant companies, I would put them in the good category. Now, that doesn't excuse things that they've done, and then we can dive into the nuance of it. But it seems like there is a general agreement among, and particularly in the media, and I would even argue among Democrats and Republicans in DC, that Facebook is bad. And I wonder what you think, why that is. And if you disagree with me, why you think that maybe they're worse than I'm giving them credit for.
I mean, I can get into that. I'd say, like, right off the bat, I'm most frustrated by the fact that it has to be this like good and bad frame, right? It's very similar to this idea that, like, I would see in a lot of places, right? That, like, especially like in spaces like Twitter, around the election where people are like, well, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's a Republican. And I was like, no. And then people would be like, well, Mark Zuckerberg's, you know, like a rabid liberal, obviously, like look at this stuff. And I was like, well, I mean, there's maybe more of a case for that to some degree, but really what he is his politics are Facebook. His politics are the growth of Facebook as an organization, not necessarily even like revenue and bottom line. I'm talking about the growth of Facebook and our reliance on Facebook and our daily use of Facebook. Like yeah. that is his whole reason for being. Everyone I talk to who knows him or has worked for the company, like that's the thing. This is his life's work. This is his project, his ambition. It's the thing. It's why he's not going to step down, all this stuff. So yeah, that whole, I feel like almost like the Republican Democrat thing, right? Is like people trying to do that. Oh, is he good or is he bad? Is he this or is he that? And it's like, well, you're kind of missing the point. And the real issue is like, are the effects of Facebook on the world good or bad? Right. And there's going to be a mix of all of those. Like, I think some of the reporting that we saw from all of these papers in the Wall Street Journal's Facebook files, when you look at some of the stuff that's been happening in developing nations and the way that they bust into a country and just, throw their products out there and they don't even have, content moderation services in the languages of the countries they're going into, like that's incredibly negligent, especially when you know that they can be leveraged by political parties on all sides to, promote different kinds of propaganda. I mean, that's negligent behavior. And that is a net negative for those places, at the end of the day. Now, granted, bringing lots of help, helping to bring people into the information age or the online information age, rather, like that is positive. Like there's a lot of, there's a lot of social movements. There's a lot of there's knitting clubs, there's, societal yeah. fabric things that are lovely and joyful and connection with people and, like staying in touch with people. And Facebook's so big. I'm sorry if I'm rambling here, but like Facebook is just so big that there's going to be some really, heartwarming things. And there's going to be some catastrophic stuff that is actually probably, eroding our ability to talk to each other as a society. And it just kind of all gets reduced down to this, like, is Mark Zuckerberg the mustache twirling billionaire cackling as regions are, being thrown into authoritarian chaos? And it's like, well, probably not. But like, right. Are they operating in reckless ways in some capacities and really need to, be held accountable for that? Absolutely.
Yeah. I think this is kind of something you got at in a piece that I thought was really great. Talk about nuanced. The Biden Facebook fight is part of the problem. This was in July. And this came about when Joe Biden said, they're killing people. Facebook is killing people. And that is what he just said outright. And you noted in the piece, I would say maybe it was off the cuff, maybe not. Maybe it was, and this was all in this context of the dangers of misinformation and disinformation that was being spread on the platform. But this feels like kind of almost purposely over the top rhetoric to scare people. And I think Facebook's a platform. I think that people who can misuse Facebook and people can use Facebook in ways that are right. But I really look at something like this and the way that went down and I worry about the overreach, and I think it's only cheerleaded by kind of pro censorship forces in the media, which seems odd to me. Seem to like this idea of broad brush crackdowns on quote unquote misinformation without really thinking about what the ramifications of that might of that what that might be down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we see like I think we interpret certain things with different probably political and social valences, but like broadly speaking, I mean, I think that Biden example, right, is how to put this, like I think that there was like a desperation there, right? Like he's looking at vaccination numbers and he's seeing that there's an issue and certainly there is there's vaccine misinformation on the platform, like information that is not correct about what vaccines do for you, right? Like it's just that's a fact.
There's incorrect information out there. Yes.
Yeah. And he, I think there's a, you know, that statement is Facebook is killing people is based off of, you know, like a bit of a, some desperation there and obviously real frustration of trying to get a specific message out and having it be countered. And it's one of those things where you kind of wonder, like, is it productive or is it not productive? And I lean on the side of it's not a productive way to talk about it, just because what it ends up doing is creating the very conversation that you and I are having instead of addressing the actual issues at hand. And I think some of this also comes from the fact that, like, I mean, we've yet to have an internet, like a president who is, like, you know, really native to the internet or something. Like, I'm sure Joe Biden has used Facebook once or twice or something, you know, but, like, you have people weighing in.
The closest we have is the last president. It was as close to Twitter native as you can get.
And also didn't, like, I don't think has ever had an email address or something, you know? So it's like, it's weird. I think there's a little bit of, like, you know, not speaking from a lot of raw expertise about the information realm, so to speak. I think that's an unproductive way to frame a conversation. And I do see, you know, I really do. I struggle with this. Going back to the, you know, like, we'll stick with this theme of nuance, right? Like, I think that there's a lot that these platforms need to be held accountable for because of the fact that they've grown and made, you know, tons of money off of stuff that is, you know, totally fine and frivolous, but also a lot of, you know, garbage that I think is actually detrimental to people. And it doesn't even have to be political garbage, right? It's just, like, crap. And I think that there's, you know, I still don't think, like, despite all the negative media coverage, like, there hasn't been a lot of, you know, real accountability, right? Like, you've had some slap on the wrist fines for Facebook, et cetera. But what I'm trying to say is, like, I think at one point, you know, or on one side of it, what someone like Biden said there is kind of counterproductive for the reasons. I can also understand the impulse of, like, what is going to get people to, you know, to hold, you know, people accountable for some of their missteps and some of their reckless, you know, behavior, like, or corporate architecture, right? It's tough.
Yeah, it is. And I get the instinct to hold people accountable, but this idea on Facebook, and you mentioned, you know, political sides. I mean, I'm an independent, but I think I look at someone like Josh Hawley, who wants to go in there and blow up, you know, 230. And I don't think is really thinking through the ramifications of what that would be. I worry about something like that. If 230 goes away, is there going to be, instead of retroactive censorship, okay, you know, we're going to take down conservative posts that, you know, that we think is a violation, that there's going to be proactive censorship. And it's going to be much more sweeping, that, you know, instead of hitting send when you go to tweet something, it gets going out there and maybe getting taken down or getting you suspended. It goes into some sort of, you know, portal where someone has to read it and decide if it goes out there. And that I think is really going to backfire, and it's going to be the slippery slope that the right is not really expecting.
Yeah, I you know, I don't think it's going to get that wild that quickly. But I think that there is an, you know, with, like, I don't think a lot of people are going to stand for, like, and I'm talking about people across the political spectrum for any kind of, you know, like, censorship over who has to read the tweets from what company before they go out. Like, I just don't think as a society we can put some of that back in the box so quickly without huge pushback. And I'm talking very broadly, because we have become used as a society to, you know, speaking our minds in all these different, you know, new forums. But I broadly agree with this, and have been trying to sort of bang the drum of, we have to be very, very careful about the solutions here. And I know that that's super annoying as someone who's long been saying, like, we do need some accountability for these platforms, for these companies. We do need to make sure that, you know, that if they set up terms of services and rules, that they adhere to their own rules and, you know, don't apply them, unfairly. But yeah, the way that I look at this, at the issue of, you know, big tech and platforms and the, you know, the wild democratization of speech that we've seen on the internet, like this sort of flourishing of all this speech, of all these different voices, et cetera, it's obviously chaotic. It's obviously good in some ways. It's obviously, you know, worrisome in other ways. It's like a printing press style, you know, like shift, right? And you watch those things are, you know, if not generational, they're multi-generational. Like it takes so much time for us to understand exactly what's happening, exactly, you know, what our, you know, as a society to find consensus on how we want to talk to each other now in these spaces, you know, what those rules need to be, what productive conversation looks like versus, you know, what unproductive and toxic crappy conversations look like, you know, who should have access to, you know, what levels of exemption, you know, politicians and whatever, newsworthiness exemptions, all those things. Like, we're not going to figure that out and come to some consensus on it really quickly, right? Because it's like societal and generational, and we haven't had sort of a, you know, a, we haven't all ever been connected in this way. And yeah. So one thing I worry about is people saying like, okay, well, if we can just amend this one law right here, right? If we can just like, this is the core problem. And if we change some of the speech, or if we get rid of it, or if we do whatever, like snap your fingers and, you know, we can wash our hands of this pesky problem and we're right, done. Facebook and it's up. Like,
yeah,
fixed. And it's like, it's not like there, you know, I think that there's plenty to talk about in breaking up Facebook and taking away some of their corporate power so that, you know, they have less leverage when it comes to when you know, when we do want to talk about different solutions, right? Because it's not great if they have so much power that, like, you know, there's literally nothing you could do to keep them in check from doing, you know, really harmful societal level things. But at the same time, you know, spinning out WhatsApp, Instagram, and Facebook, that's not a silver bullet. And it might not even solve some of the problems you think. And it might create some other problems that we don't know about. I just think there's this feeling right now, especially with people who, you know, who have been super critical, understandably, of companies like Facebook, that it's sort of like, we need to find the quick fix because the problem is really serious. And my understanding or my sort of entreaty to them is like, this is going to take a really long time and it's going to be messy. And we have to sort of understand that. It doesn't mean don't look for solutions. Don't look for ways to make, you know, everything better, but a quick fix may do as much harm as what we're seeing right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these problems are bigger than the platforms too. I think that's certainly true. Coming up, Charlie and I dive into another social platform, Twitter, and whether it's helping destroy the media's credibility, plus the business of newsletters. But first, how do you fight disinformation and misinformation? Well, with good information or something. A group of billionaire left-wing activists got together recently to launch Good Information Inc., which, according to Axios, promises to fund new media companies in efforts to tackle disinformation. Investors behind the company include George Soros and Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn. Let's put Soros to the side for a minute, although a lot could be written about him. Hoffman is a tech billionaire who comes to the world of fighting disinformation by having participated in disinformation dissemination himself. During the 2017 Alabama Senate race, which saw Doug Jones defeat Roy Moore, Hoffman funded a group of Democratic tech experts who tried to emulate Russian election tampering tactics by, in their own words, orchestrating an elaborate false flag operation that planted the idea that the Moore campaign was amplified on social media by a Russian botnet. Hoffman was forced to apologize the next year. Running this good information company poised to debunk misinformation is Tara McGowan, a former Democratic operative who previously ran the Courier Newsroom, a group of websites purporting to be local news sites but were actually pushing Democratic talking points. Courier Newsroom, which solely produced news favorable to Democratic candidates and elected officials, an unusual blend of newsroom and political action committee that might, in less polite company, be termed propaganda, was how Veitch reported it. So, in the next few years, when you start hearing about how good information is fighting against the disinformation that it surely will find coming solely from the right wing of the internet, remember who the forces are behind this scam with the creepy sounding name. More with Charlie coming up, but first, the Fourth Watch, podcast is presented by The First TV. The First is a new network for free speech and big ideas featuring Bill O'Reilly, Dana Lash, Buck Sexton, and more. It's a forum for new thought, new approaches, and an enlightening voice for a new America that embraces the founding principles and ideals that form the greatest country on the planet. The First is free. No subscription, no credit card, no trial, no censorship. Watch The First TV on Pluto TV, Distro TV, Apple TV, The First TV app, and more. Go to thefirsttv.com to learn more. And now, back to Charlie Warzel. I know, you know, from your goodbye note on Substack is something that you have conflicted feelings about for sure. I certainly do as well. I've tried to quit Twitter many times. It's I think it's fair to say there's an addictive quality to it, at least for what I do. And I think for a lot of journalism, and I you wrote a piece, which this was back in 2020, and about Felicia Sanmez and a sort of social media policy at legacy media outlets. But it really, I think, kind of gets to the point of like, is Twitter a net positive or net negative thing for a media that has such a huge impact on and populates it at a much greater percentage than any other, say, you know, occupation in the country? Is it good or is it not good? And again, I know that's sort of simplistic way of looking at it.
Sure.
But it's such a huge part of the way media works these days on a lot of levels. And and I wonder if it's changed the way the media works in ways that it doesn't really comprehend how the audience is seeing it as a sort of erosion of what the core goals were in the first place.
It's so complicated, you know, in the sense of, I really dislike when people say, when the people use the phrase, Twitter isn't real life, right? Like I wrote about this a few times at the New York Times. Like, obviously Twitter is not a, like, you know, an accurate simulacrum of society, right? Like, obviously the conversations there are specific, and there's a certain type of person that uses Twitter. There's a certain type of person who's allowed on Twitter and has a lot of followers. There's a certain segment, you know, of people who are on there who, you know, like, especially in the media, who have different, who are focused on different things. And so obviously that's the case, but I also think people use that phrase, right, to dismiss things that they don't, you know, want to deal with, right? So like when you look at the way that, like, just let's just take Black Lives Matter, like in that organization, when I wrote about this argument, it's like, you know, it's a major social movement of, you know, the last 5-7 years. And it was kind of a native Twitter movement to some degree. Yeah. I mean, and then you can talk about, you know, different elements of, like, let's just say like the pro-Trump media, et cetera, and different, you know, hashtag campaigns and things like that. And things that were native to that, that grew out of that, right? They were small, they found voices on there. And also like those movements were, you know, you can like the movement or hate the movement or whatever, it represents a real constituency, probably not a majority constituency when you're talking about some of these, you know, either activist movements or political movements, but it's real. And like, to listen to it makes, like, we should be listening to it. The media should be listening to it. And to dismiss it as like a Twitter thing is probably, like, you're probably doing that at a detriment. Just because it doesn't have critical mass doesn't mean it's not real, especially if it's finding a home on social media and a place like Twitter.
Yeah, so there's a democratization to it, but the pendulum can also swing the other direction.
Totally.
Right? I mean, you know, even just like, you know, I've got whatever, 40,000 followers, you've got a lot more than that. It can feel like when you tweet something and it like go, you know, takes off, and then all of a sudden it's like a couple hundred or a couple thousand people even that retweeted it, and all of a sudden you feel, or vice versa. I mean, if you've ever been in the, you know, getting in the ratio in Twitter, you know, it can feel like the world is collapsing on you. And I think that there's an element of that is not necessarily representative of, and I would say that's on a personal level, but for companies, you know, a company that does something and then all of a sudden gets 20 angry tweets, it can feel like, holy shit, like, this is like, we have to, like, you know, have a, let's get all the executives together. This is, you know, and there's something that feels, it's so public that it can feel bigger than it is also.
100%. And I was, that was sort of like where I was heading with, especially with the media too, is it being a negative is when you over index that signal, right? When you over inflate the importance of that. And I think that it's a big problem with, you know, with a lot of political punditry is people see, you know, an argument on Twitter that's, you know, somewhat confined. And it, again, it's representative of something, right? But like, it's taken as like, it's scooped out and it's portrayed as like, well, this is what America is, right? This is what, you know, this is the future liberals want, et cetera, like whatever it is. Yeah. And it's like, well, I mean, it's maybe some, but like, it, you know, you start painting with these broad brushes. And I think that there are a lot of people, a lot of pundits and stuff out there that I would love to see, you know, I log off and stop over indexing these arguments to the degree that they are, or at least to portray them as, hey, you know, this is a tenet of X political philosophy that I think is worth interrogating, instead of this is the Republican Party, this is the Democratic Party, this is this, and everyone is you know, can be caught up in that, self very much included. You know, one of my favorite like lines about social media that I've heard in like the last year or two is that like it requires us to act with so much grace, you know, like in a perfect world, like to have a really perfect social media experience, everyone has to act with so much restraint and grace and understanding and empathy. And it's like the medium does not incentivize that. And so what ends up happening is we end up, you know, we end up acting sort of the opposite way. And that's like the way to have the least productive conversations with it. Well, and it's just a fact, it's, you know, part of the architecture of the platforms.
And that kind of brings me back to the newsletters, because I think the perfect antidote to Twitter is the newsletter. You know, it's almost the opposite of the way people, you know, interact in sort of the headline, the 280 characters versus a long form newsletter like that. And you know, going back now to the post that you wrote, and you got real into the weeds with it, right? 16,000 mm-hmm. subscribers, 1,400 that are paying, which, you know, I think for, as someone who writes a newsletter that's free right now, I would say if I got 10%, you know, if I turned on a paid feature and got 10% of my subscribers to be paying something, I think that would be a huge, huge success. I think that's an enormous number. It also reminded me back in April, I was having a Twitter argument with Ian Bremmer, who was saying you're about to be a millionaire. And I was saying that, no, probably not. But if you get like, you know, and I even wrote 2,000 paying subs, I mean, that cost benefit starts to get really good. And that's not that many. And obviously you were very close to that even after just a few months. So I think it's interesting that, you know, you got into it. And I also want to kind of dovetail the economics of it, which I think are important, with two other features that you brought up. One is the way that subscribers who are paying felt that they kind of wanted a certain kind of value in return, and what it did, if it made you moderate or change kind of how you covered things or how you wrote about things based on the feedback. And then I want to talk about Glenn Greenwald. So
sure. It didn't moderate I can imagine in some respect, if I wrote about different things, maybe that it would, you know, like, I think I put myself in a decent spot with that, where I kind of said, this is going to be long and meandering, and, you know, I'm going to sort of noodle over these topics, and I think it's going to be a little, like, I wanted to sort of get into the nuance with this newsletter and sort of agonize over that and always sort of try to pin for that. So I think because that was what a lot of people were signing up for, there wasn't a lot of like, why didn't you say this?
Right.
But I do think, like, you know, it's part of the, on sort of a different side of that conversation, was like, I was really concerned a lot about like, am I providing the right value, right? Like, what amount of things need to be free versus what needs to be paid? You know, I want to grow this thing, so I want more people to see stuff. And, you know, there's this idea of like, you know, that Substack says to people, it's like, put your best stuff, you know, make your best stuff free, and, you know, then do, you know, a lot of other stuff behind the paywall. I didn't want to write so much that I was writing stuff that I was actively like, I don't really think this is very good. I'm just going to give it to the people who are paying. It's like, well, what? I never really understood that. But it was also, I don't want to write. I've kind of made a lot of stuff free, which meant a lot of people were paying in sort of a patronage model. They wanted to, they were like, I like what you do. I want you to be able to do it independently. And so I'll also underwrite it for other people. I think that's awesome. That's like the dream of the internet, right?
Right.
I think I'm really humbled by that. But at the same time too, it's like, I just agonized over a lot of these choices. Like how much am I writing? What am I doing? And then, I'd have people say like, unsubscribe from the paid tier and say, man, everything is free. What am I paying for? And being, frustrated with that, or I'd have people, say, I cannot keep up with how much you write. I'm unsubscribing and I'm not paying anymore. And then I'd have people be like, why aren't you writing more? I'm unsubscribing. And so you're just like, you're agonizing over a lot of that stuff and kind of constantly trying to, you can get in a space, right? And this is like the classic like creator issue where you're just like you're trying to tailor to these like opposing opinions and viewpoints, and you end up not doing what you set out to do. Like if I was going to give anyone going down this independent newsletter path their thing, it's like, do the thing you want to do. Like this is your thing. And like, just you will, if you do it really well and you know that there's an audience for it, you like let those people who need 25 pieces of content a week from you, like don't like, let them slip off, because you actually want the readers who are here and respect your process essentially.
Yeah. I mean, the feedback mechanism is so much greater than if you were at the New York Times doing this or at the Atlantic doing this. It's right there. And it has such a great impact on your life, so it's hard to do that, but it makes sense. But that also leads, okay, Glenn Greenwald, you mentioned him either by name or by reference. I think it was 4 times in that mm-hmm. post. He then of course tweeted about it, and you tweeted about mm-hmm. it. I don't know if it's a feud or if it's just sort of a fun thing, but I do think you kind of describe it as grievance blogging. And I know Glenn does a variety of things, but I think there's some level of what he does that goes really deep into some sort of, thing that's kind of bubbling up on social media. But I also look at it as like a Glenn Greenwald, a Matt Taibbi. These are people that for some reason we've realigned the media and they've become these kind of outcasts in what they do, but they also have these great careers as journalists for a long time. And so I wonder if you look at it and like, what is it about the Glenn Greenwald thing that you find this foil with?
I think that he right now in this iteration of time is one of the people that I would say over indexes based off of being relatively addicted to Twitter. I think he takes a lot of those arguments and sees them as incredibly indicative of exactly the point he's willing to prove.
That's what you were telling to log off.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean that in a sense of like, it's just like it, I wrote this a while back. So, I mean, the reason why there's this like, I don't even know what you'd call it, back and forth, it is because when I left the Times for Substack 2 weeks in, he looked at my leaderboard stats. And again, it was honestly more like 12 days. Right. And he was like, he only has hundreds of paid subscribers. Like it's very clear that this is a failure. And I was like, dude, like, I don't have a Pulitzer Prize. I didn't start my own media company, with the founder of eBay, right? Like I don't have that public profile. I have a public profile. I'm not saying I'm, like a guy off the street or anything, but like, yes, I'm not a household name. So like, this is going to go a little bit slow, but I kind of use that as a way of like, I looked through some of his stuff and I found that it was, again, he would call it righteous anger, righteous indignation, and opinion journalism. It seemed very much to me like he was over-indexing and assigning extra importance to a lot of, as I described it, like internecine internet beefs. and I was, it's not what I wanted to do. Like when he tweeted about me, I got like stuck in his like replies, and it was just people like, I mean, it was just people who had so much anger towards me for, and like literally I, to that point, I don't think I had really criticized him or written about him or anything like that. It was just like this New York Times shill trying to do this thing. He, of course he's going to fail because he's a no talent neoliberal hack who worked for the New York Times opinion page. Like, why don't you go start another, you know, war in the Middle East? And it's like, okay, well, I was in seventh grade when we invaded, you know, Iraq. So anyhow, I was like, this is a really like, it just seems like his existence is like pretty miserable right now in terms of like his online existence. And I was like, so that's why I say like, yeah, log off. Like just like, there's just so much of that negativity there. But what I do want to say is that like, I wrote at the end of the you know, I'm leaving Substack post. I said that like, you know, Substack is good for people. Like it seems to be working better for people who don't have immediate homes elsewhere. And like, I think he and a couple other people took that to mean like, oh, you know, I'm saying I'm unpublishable or whatever. But like, I think, you know, like his public fallout with The Intercept, you know, showed he didn't really want to be edited or have anyone constrain his views. Like he, you know, there's, if you are not actively, if you have a big profile and you're not actively being courted by other places, and there's not like a, you know, a number of mainstream media organizations who want to like lap you up, then you going to Substack, like that's just naturally the way content works. That's going to make it very popular, right? It's a voice that wouldn't have a home elsewhere. Yeah. I wasn't really necessarily making a value judgment about it. I was saying that like, that's why it's popular. Like people want to do that. I also believe that he pisses a lot of people off. I think Taibbi pisses a lot of people off, and there's a lot of people who delight in that. And they're like, keep doing it, keep writing. I'm going to pay you to do that. I don't think my work necessarily is of like, I don't think that's what I'm doing. Yeah. And I also think that it provides less of an incentive for people to pay me, you know, like I was very honest about the fact that like, I probably work best as a suite of people, like, you know, in a suite of people who are ideas writers or, you know, like as a package because right. of the fact that like, I just the nature of my work is not like, I'm going to say the thing that literally no one else will say. I just want to be more interesting.
Yeah. Which is kind of what you started with the side channel Discord, which I don't totally understand, but I think that was like a consortium of people, right? That were kind of, you know, in the same boat of thinking about things in certain ways, but not individualized that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get where you're coming from with Glenn. I have to say though, you know, I like Glenn. I think that one of the things though is there has been this realignment where like, you know, yes, he burned the bridge as publicly as he could with The Intercept, but mm-hmm. it was over what was going to happen with Hunter Biden. And you know, it was, we're in this time now where I think the window of what is, you know, a place that would want a Glenn Greenwald or a Matt Taibbi and want them to be them is dwindling. And yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I don't know if that's a good thing though, necessarily for the broader media. I think that, you know, certain people, you know, if he wasn't doing long 2000 word posts about internet beef, you know, well reported out, which, you know, is only part of what he does. I think that there is still a place for the types of reporting that he does that, you know, is just not really going to be welcomed in certain places anymore. But
I think it's hard because like, you know, part of that, like, I didn't pay as like extreme attention to it, but I think like, I think a little of what you're saying is definitely correct. And then I think another part of it is like, when you looked at that Intercept fallout, there's like, some of it was like, hey, we were just trying to get you to like, you know, abide by like our editing standards. And it was like, absolutely not. I refuse to be edited. It's like, okay, right. Well,
so his contract or something that he was not allowed to be edited.
And,
so.
And hey, you know what? Like that's part of what you can do when you're a household name.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is like, I, you know, I think it's tough. I don't want to see an internet environment that's like completely sterilized. I also think there's like a news opinion sections that are completely sterilized. I also think there's truth to a lot of the people who are like online at being like, dude, do the journalist, like do some of that investigative reporting, like even some of the, a lot of the stuff he did, about Brazil and The Intercept. It's do more of that, please. And less like arguing about something you saw on Twitter, because you clearly have a talent, like a Pulitzer Prize winning talent at the other thing. The internet beefing is really just like, it's, everyone's exhausted by it, including yourself. And is it getting us to a better place? Are we talking to each other more and more productively? Like, I think you can make a good argument. No. So yeah. Anyhow, I it's not too deep for me, and I'm not super wounded. I just saw it as sort of, he was kind of trying to do the opposite thing that I was trying to do. And that's totally understandable. And one of them is proved to be very lucrative. And one of them, my thing, proved to be less lucrative.
Fourth Watch Lightning Round is coming up. But first, his new book on the future of work and being a writer on tech and culture while living in Montana. You have a book coming out next month with your partner that you write. I want you to tell me about that, future of work. And then also, you, like I, outside of the Acela Media, as I call it, New York and DC, you're out of San Francisco in the tech world, and you're in Montana. So what is that like? What is life like there? And tell me about the book.
Sure. They kind of dovetail. My partner is from Idaho originally, and we both worked at BuzzFeed News. And in 2017, we sort of saw an opportunity to get outside of, there was a little bit of a, like, reporters need to understand America better. and she wanted to move, closer to home. And we saw this opportunity to, to be able to get outside of New York, and took it. And it was going to be, probably like a short-term thing, like, a year or something. It became very clear within a couple of weeks of being out of that. It was like, oh no, this is great. We love this. But at the same time, I had never sort of worked remotely. I and my partner sort of, we were so concerned about doing well and justifying our being outside of the office that we just like totally destroyed the work-life balance in our lives. Like all we did, like I was getting cold sweats watching like Netflix on the couch on a Friday night because the couch was also my office. It's like where I did my work. It was just this, total, messing with my head.
Yeah,
exactly. And we kind of figured it out, right? Figured out a little bit how to actually make like a flexible work life, like actually working from home, changing the rhythms of our days, and also kind of decentering work in our lives, which a place like New York really centers work in your life. It makes it the absolute focal point. So when the pandemic rolled around, we realized that everyone was kind of speed running our experiment, and we had something to say. So we did a lot of reporting, talked to hundreds of people, and wrote this book. It's called Out of Office: the Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. And it's really about like the future of work, but the future of like work in our lives, and like how we can be three-dimensional people. So many people are, like, we just devote so much of our time and energy and attention and our best selves to our jobs, and we let other things fall by the wayside. And, as we reported this, we kind of realized that there's legitimately, I think there's a lot of hope here if we can actually truly rethink a little bit of our relationship to it. We've been able, as, our process of decentering work in our lives has allowed us to like be more community focused, right? Volunteer more, do more things, like have ties to organizations and people outside of our jobs. And I think that community life, that emphasis on, family, friends, community is a big part of, what a lot of us are missing, and a big part of why, a lot of the problems we've talked about have that kind of current running underneath them, right? In American life and culture. And so I think that there's a way in which this isn't, again, there's no silver bullet here, but we wanted to sort of write a book that showed, you know, the ways in which our lives can be richer and more three-dimensional.
Yeah. And I would say that sort of balance can only make the work better too. So
totally, 100%.
All right. Sounds great. Last thing, 6 questions, 60 seconds. Where were you born?
Cleveland, Ohio.
You're the editor of the Galaxy Brain newsletter. What's one benefit and one cost of the role?
The benefit is that I can publish whatever I want. The cost is that I have less of an ability to have the gut check.
Who's someone who's been a mentor for you?
Oh, geez. It's a good question. From the reporting side, Ben Smith at BuzzFeed was a tenacious reporter. And from the the work-life balance side, my partner, Annie.
Who's one person that you really like professionally or personally that may surprise people?
I'm trying to think. I think the thing that would really surprise people is that I have recently become friends with all sorts of people in the golf media world. I'm obsessed with golf. So
really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's funny. Me too. I'm a big daily fantasy sports golf fan. Who's one person in the media you think's really interesting or talented that isn't getting enough attention?
Shoshana Wodinsky. She writes about advertising technology at Gizmodo. She's absolutely brilliant. And I think she's working on the stuff that's the beating heart of why the internet is bad, but it's so technical that I think she's not getting the love she deserves for it.
All right. Last one. 1 year from today, what is one prediction for the media?
I think we're going to focus a lot on the importance of the metaverse. And I think that that's something that we're on the first yard line, or that we're on the 1 yard line with that. And I think a lot of people think it's going to be there. We're going to blink our eyes and live in the metaverse. And I think it's going to take a decade.
Charlie, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Charlie Warzel. That was fun. Go subscribe to his newsletter, I guess. That's what we should say here. And remember, subscribe to my newsletter, Fourth Watch, not just a podcast, also a newsletter. Go to fourthwatch.media. Join me. Let's build a better media together. If you like the music in the show as I do, check out the artist who created it, Super Duper. That's Super Duper Music on Instagram. The song is Far From Falling. Download it wherever you get your music. And download this podcast. Like, rate, review, subscribe, all those things on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Back soon. Stay safe. Talk to you then.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.